Today we will switch over from the discussion of the creation of particles due to curvature and expansion to the amplification of fluctuations of fields. So we will start with a discussion again of particle creation. We will wrap that up. It's a very useful discussion because, for example, in the Hawking effect, it is central to understand how particles can be created because of the behavior of space-time. But in cosmology, it will turn out that the calculation of the fluctuations of fields will be more important. So we will switch over to that today. Ultimately, we want to be able to calculate pictures like that that show quantum fluctuations of fields, because it is thought in the standard model of cosmology that such quantum fluctuations are responsible for the structure in the cosmic microwave background and therefore for all structure in the universe. So let's summarize in the next few slides how space-time expansion can create particles. And then we'll go through a similar study for the amplification of quantum fluctuations. Remember that the quantum field chi has to obey several conditions, the hermeticity conditions, the canonical commutation relations, and the Klein-Gordon equation. The solution can be written in this form, mode functions times creation and annihilation operators. And the mode functions have to obey two equations. The mode functions have to be a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation, and they have to be a solution to the so-called Wronskian condition, which ensures that the commutation relations between A and A dagger imply the proper commutation relations between chi and its canonically conjugate field. Then, once we regulate the ansatz by imposing an ultraviolet and an infrared cutoff, at least temporarily, we can conclude with the theorem of Stone and von Neumann that the representation of the field theory is unique, and we obtain, therefore, that in principle, it doesn't really matter which mode functions Vk we choose. As long as they obey the criterion above, it doesn't really matter. Any solution of the Klein-Gordon equation that also fulfills the Wronskian condition will do. And whatever choice of mode function we choose, the quantum field can always be represented in terms of it. So the quantum field can be represented in this way using one set of mode functions along with its A and A dagger operators, or another set of mode functions along with its A and dagger operators. So whether they are untilded or tilded or whatever, they describe the same quantum field. And in principle, we could just stick to one choice of mode functions throughout. In whatever situation, we can always do that. It's a matter of convenience to sometimes choose this representation, sometimes choosing that one. Now, remember that when we make a choice of mode functions, then that choice comes with its own A and A dagger operators. And we can use those A and A dagger operators, or A tildes, etc. We can use them to build a Hilbert space representation. So the vector in the Hilbert space that's annihilated by A, we denote like that. The one that's annihilated by A tilde will be denoted like this. So every choice of mode function gives us a natural choice of bases in the Hilbert space. And Stone and von Neumann's theorem implies simply that these choices of bases are all choices of bases within the same Hilbert space. So there always is a unitary transformation that maps one basis into the other basis. Just a matter of representation, the physics is the same whether we describe it this way or that way. And the Hilbert basis that we obtain, the orthonormal basis that we obtain for the Hilbert spaces, are of course the basis that look like this. We have the vector 0 here, then we apply creation operators once or many times, and in this way we get lots of basis vectors. This is just to ensure that this vector is normalized, and overall this spans the Hilbert space, and that is just another basis, the basis of the tilted vectors. Then we made some effort to calculate what the change of basis actually looks like. And the starting point for calculating how the change of basis from one of those Hilbert bases to the other explicitly looks like, the starting point was the observation that the Klein-Gordon equation in momentum space really has only a two-dimensional solution space for each k, because it's just second order in time. So it has two independent solutions. It's a two complex dimensional solution space. And in particular, if V is one of those complex solutions, then V star is a linearly independent complex solution. And together, they span the space of solutions. Therefore, any other solution to the Klein-Gordon equation has to be a linear combination of V and V star. So if we choose one eligible mode function, then it and its complex conjugate span the solution space. And then if we decide to consider also another mode function, another solution to the Klein-Gordon equation, then whatever we choose, well, it's a linear combination of the original choice V and V star. And we can specify the new mode function through those parameters, through those coefficients alpha and beta. By the way, it turned out that the alpha and beta are not completely arbitrary. Well, they are arbitrary if all what you want is that the V tilde is a solution of the Klein-Gordon equation. But if you also want that it is eligible as a mode function, then it means that it also has to obey the Wronskian condition. And that imposes a bit of a constraint on the alpha and beta. If you remember, we had an equation for that. So in any case, we know that any other choice of mode function and everything that comes along with it, any other choice of mode function can be specified by specifying those coefficients that express the new mode function in terms as a linear combination of the old ones. And then, remembering that the quantum field can be represented one way or the other way, which means in particular that this is equal to that, then we can use the fact that we can express the V tildes in terms of the Vs to express also the A tildes in terms of the A's. And what we found was this. We found that if we start with a mode function V and its complex conjugate, and then we choose parameters alpha and beta to define a new mode function, then along with this new mode function come, of course, also tilted A and A Dagger operators. And those A and A, those tilted A and A Dagger operators are related to the untilted ones in this way. Now we've expressed the A and A Dagger operators of one choice of mode function to the, in terms of those of the other choice. And that was crucial because it meant that we could This equation was crucial because it meant that we could rewrite the defining equation for the Hilbert basis that comes with one choice of mode function, and this one, this is the defining equation of what the Hilbert basis was going to be, because we define here the starting vector with this condition from which we build up all the bases. That defining equation, we were now able to write in terms of the tilted operators, right? Because we are able to express A in terms of this, and then express that vector 0 in terms of some as yet unknown linear combination of the tilted basis vectors. So we had tilted operators acting on tilted basis vectors. And that equation was then solvable, and this was the outcome. We find that the starting vector for creating the Fock basis that is untilted can be expressed in this way, namely as a complex, as a very complicated, ultimately linear combination of basis vectors in of the tilted basis. Just have to view this exponential as a series, and then term by term, you get a dagger operators acting on this vector here, and so you build up, you get basis vectors of the tilted basis with certain coefficients. And once we know how that basic starting vector of the untilted basis is represented in the tilted basis, we can express every vector that's untilted in the tilted way, because we get every vector on this side by simply acting from the left with a certain number of creation operators that are untilted. But the untilted creation operators can be expressed in terms of tilted operators using this. Just take the Hermitian conjugate of that equation. And then on the left-hand side, you have, let's say, a dagger to the fifth power. On the right-hand side, you will have that sort of thing to the fifth power, but tilted, right? So it's all really fine. So that enabled us to go back and forth between different choices of mode functions and therefore different choices of representation for our quantum field, different Hilbert bases. Then we made use of this to conveniently identify situations in which particles will be created. We started with this observation. In general, the vacuum state will be a different Hilbert space vector at different times. And why is that? Well, it's because we used the Heisenberg picture, if you remember. We used the Heisenberg picture. And in the Heisenberg picture, the meaning of vectors can change. Meaning of vectors in the Hilbert space can change. For example, you could have one vector in the Hilbert space that describes, I don't know, angular momentum 5 h bar, right? At one point in time, it means that. But then the angular momentum operator in the Heisenberg picture is changing in time. So it could be that the 5 h bar angular momentum state is a different vector at a later time, because the angular momentum operator is a different operator in time. So as operators evolve in time, they give a time changing meaning to the vectors in the Hilbert space. And the vacuum is no different. So the vacuum state. So if you ask which vector in the Hilbert space describes the vacuum, the answer will in general depend on the time. It will depend on when you ask. So in particular, this means that particles can be created or annihilated. Because if the system starts out in a particular state, which happens to be the vacuum state, let's say, then in the Heisenberg picture, it will always be in that state. Will always be described by that vector. But later on, that vector may no longer be the vacuum vector. The vacuum vector will be a different vector. So therefore, our system is now no longer in the vacuum state. It's still described by the same Hilbert space vector, but that vector no longer has the meaning of describing the vacuum. So it's got to describe some excited state, and therefore particles have been created. Now, let us ask, if at a time eta there exists a no particle state, and it's not trivial that it exists, today we will see an instance when it doesn't. If at a time there exists a no particle state, a vacuum state, then is it the state zero that comes along with some choice of mode function? See, if there is a vacuum state at all in nature, generically, I would say there isn't, but for Friedman, Roberts, and Walker spacetimes, usually there is. When there is a vacuum state in nature, can we describe it as, is it one of those vectors, the one with the zero or the zero tilde or so? Is there a choice of mode function such that this particular Hilbert space vector happens to be the vacuum vector? Well, it depends. What we found is that when we checked, we found a really good candidate for that. We tried at first with identifying the vacuum vector as the lowest energy vector. That didn't work out because we found that that would imply the prediction of more particle production than is consistent with observation, even today. What we did find is that a good candidate, and currently the established candidate, accepted candidate for the vacuum state, is that state in the Hilbert space at a particular time, right? We always ask at a particular time, what's the vacuum state, which vector in the Hilbert space describes the vacuum at a particular time eta? So the established criterion for finding that vacuum state is the following. It's that vector, 0, which comes with that mode function that obeys these two conditions at the time in question. So you pick a time, eta, and you ask, which vector in the Hilbert space describes the vacuum? Well, here's the procedure. Calculate the mode function that has this amplitude at the time eta and that derivative at the time eta. The mode function is fixed by that because the Klein-Gordon equation is just second order in time, giving an amplitude, and the derivative is sufficient. So now you have the mode function everywhere. So now you have a choice of mode function. But a choice of mode function always comes along with A and A dagger operators. And the A operator defines a vector 0. And that's the vacuum vector. That vector happens to be describing the vacuum state at the time eta. We argue that this is a good criterion, at least when, I mean, definitely when space-time is expanding slowly, adiabatically, as it is now. But in principle, we can apply it even much more generally. However, there is one instance when this criterion is bound to fail. And that is when there simply isn't a vacuum state at all. Because this is always picking out a vacuum state. It's always picking out some vector in the Hilbert space. Because it picks out the mode function, it picks out the vector, right? But what if there isn't a vacuum state? Then this criterion can't be right. When would that certainly be the case? Well, that would be the case, especially when the frequency squared is smaller than 0. And the frequency of the given mode is actually imaginary, which can happen. Remember, there was this extra term in Friedman, Robertson, Walker, Klein-Gordon equation, which made it possible that the frequency goes imaginary, the frequency squared goes negative, and what are usually oscillatory solutions of the harmonic oscillator become solutions that are exponentially decaying and exponentially increasing. Instead of having oscillations that are right turning in the complex plane and oscillations that are left turning in the complex plane, the two basic solutions, now you have one that's exponentially increasing, exponentially decreasing, because instead of having a plane wave e to the power I omega t, you would have e to the power of plus or minus omega t. In this case, as we discussed earlier, the harmonic oscillator of a mode is not this way. It's not jittery like that, as would be the case if it's non-adiabatic. Right? Non-adiabatic means that the harmonic oscillator is changing its frequency very quickly. No, that's not the case here. No, it would be the case where the harmonic oscillator completely reverses, and it has this potential, in which case the spectrum is not discrete at all. The spectrum is continuous. Right? Because there are only scattering states. There are no bound states for a potential that looks like an inverted parabola. And therefore, there can't be a vacuum state. There can't be first, second, third excited states. That doesn't work. But as it turns out, this will be just the most interesting case, actually, when this happened. It's good evidence that this happened temporarily in the very early universe. But before we move on, let me just remind you why we adopted that criterion, this so-called adiabatic vacuum criterion for identifying which state in the Hilbert space describes the vacuum at a time eta. See, the funny thing is that there's this complicated structure here. Why that? Remember that the original criterion that we had tried was to say, well, maybe the vacuum state is the lowest energy state. It's whatever vector in the Hilbert space describes the ground state of the Hamiltonian at a particular time. And the criterion for picking out the right mode function to give us the ground state of the Hamiltonian at time eta was very much looking like this one, except that term was absent. So how come that we now have this extra term here? A term which is sensitive to the rate of change of the frequency. Whereas the old criterion, our first attempt at identifying the vacuum, was not sensitive to how fast the frequency of a mode is changing, therefore how quickly the universe is expanding. Now the adiabatic vacuum criterion has some sensitivity to the rate of change of the frequency. So how did we get to this? Well, we said, let's assume that the evolution is adiabatic, the evolution of the universe, as it is at the moment, in some time interval from eta 1 to eta 2. Then it is the case that these conditions during a time of adiabatic evolution, these conditions at every point in time will, of course, pick out a mode function whose associated vector 0 describes the vacuum state, right? Now, if the universe is expanding adiabatically, then the mode functions that are being picked out by that criterion at different times eta are all the same. So it's always picking out the same mode function, which means that it's always picking out the same vector 0, which means that we are predicting no particles are being produced. Because if the universe starts out at a particular point in time in that vacuum state, then, well, later on, the universe is still described by the same state, but that state is also still the vacuum state. So therefore, this is the criterion that implies that during an adiabatic evolution, no particles are being produced. And that's consistent with observations because we haven't seen any particles being produced just by the mere fact of the universe expanding now. And by the way, how do we check that this criterion picks out the same mode function at every time, as long as the evolution is adiabatic? Well, if the evolution is adiabatic, which means slow, the frequency is slowly changing, then this is a very good approximation to what the mode function is in time. Here's a time dependence, there's a time dependence. And if you just calculate what the amplitude is and what the derivative is of this so-called adiabatic solution, you find that they obey the criterion above at all times. And then we said, well, I already said that. So what this says is that the astronomical observations are saying that the minimum energy, the idea that the state of minimum energy would be the vacuum state implies a prediction of too much particle production. Therefore, we switch to another criterion, the adiabatic vacuum criterion, which implies that there's no particle production to lowest order in perturbation theory, no particle production when the universe is expanding adiabatically. Now, let me close with a bit of intuition for where this extra term comes from. Remember, here. If we try to identify the vacuum state as the state of momentarily lowest energy, then, as we showed earlier, this is the criterion for doing it. Find that mode function which obeys this amplitude and derivative condition, and then its vector zero is guaranteed to be the state of lowest energy. But we argued that in order to be consistent with observations, we have to add this extra term here. What does that mean? What's the intuition for that term? Well, I hope you can read this. Can you read this thing in black there? Is that legible? Okay. Okay, so what it says is, consider a function of time, f of t, which is just a plane wave, let's say, e to the power of I omega t. Then how can we extract from that expression what the frequency of that plane wave is? Well, we can do it by taking the derivative of f and dividing it by f. Right? If we do that, then we get, when we take the derivative of f, we get down a factor of I omega, and then times e to the power I omega t, we divide by f, that gets rid of the plane wave, and we're just left with I omega. So if you want to pick out what is the frequency of a plane wave, in a bit of a roundabout way, but if you want to extract the frequency of it, we can just take the function and differentiate it with respect to time and divide it by the function itself. That gives us the frequency of it. In this case, it's a plane wave. It always has the same frequency. So that omega comes out the same at all time. But then we can ask, well, what if we have something that's not a plane wave? It's a much more general thing. For example, it could be a harmonic oscillator whose frequency we are changing. So this thing oscillates, but not at the same rate. It keeps changing its oscillation frequency. So let's say f of t now is a more general function, not just the plane wave. And we can ask, what is its momentary frequency? Okay. Well, one attempt at defining the momentary frequency would be to say, well, we just divide the time derivative by f. And then whatever that is, we might define to be the momentary frequency. Where, to be precise, if this thing comes out to have a real part, not just an imaginary part, a real part, it would indicate that the oscillations are going bigger and smaller, not just oscillating, but also bigger and smaller. But in any case, that's a good criterion. We can define the frequency in this way. And you see that now we have a definition of momentary frequency. Let's apply that to the case of our adiabatic solution, this one. Okay. So this is how the mode function behaves in the adiabatic case. This is the case of a harmonic oscillator that is oscillating not always at the same frequency because its parameters are changing in time. Let's calculate what we obtain for the momentary frequency. Do we really get omega of eta for the momentary frequency? See, it looks like at time eta, the momentary frequency is omega of eta. But is it according to that definition? Now, according to that definition, that the momentary frequency is given by f prime over f, or in our case here, v prime over v for the mode function, the momentary frequency actually comes out to be this. So what we find is that the momentary frequency for a harmonic oscillator that changes in time is not just given by actually the omega itself, but there is something in there that that also knows about the change of the frequency, as we might have expected. Just like in the resonance phenomena, when you have friction or some driving, you can actually change the frequency, the resonance of a harmonic oscillator by putting extra stuff on it. And now look at this term. This is the term that we have above in the criterion. It's just that. So basically what we see is that the adiabatic vacuum identification criterion, this one, basically says, choose that mode function which has the right frequency, if by right frequency we mean the one that's the momentary frequency f dot over f. And of course, when the frequency doesn't change, omega prime is equal to zero, and then we are back to what the usual thing would be. Okay, it's just a bit of intuition there. Now, our aim is to move from the particle picture to the wave picture. What we did so far is we studied the effect of space-time expansion on particle number. Particle numbers were increasing. And in principle, if you run the evolution backwards, it could also be decreasing. Or for suitable scenarios, you could even have going forward into the future that the number of particles goes down. However, we found that there are situations when, in principle, there can be situations when this sort of analysis just doesn't apply. Namely, when the interpretation of a state that we may have, of a state zero, as the vacuum state just cannot work. There cannot be a particle number, there cannot be a vacuum state, a no particle state. In fact, the very notion of particles will not work because the harmonic oscillators are not going to be this way. It's important that the harmonic oscillators are this way. It's important that the spectrum is equidistant because it means that we have particles of a kind. And each time you add another particle, you go up one step in this ladder and you get the required momentum, you get the required energy. That's all guaranteed by the harmonic oscillator having an equidistant spectrum. If harmonic oscillators didn't have an equidistant spectrum, then it wouldn't be true that all electrons have the same mass, that all particles of the same species have the same mass. It's because the harmonic oscillators all come with the same gap. Yep?
So as per that formula, the shift in frequency, the slight shift, that will depend on the frequency.
Yes.
So the shift will be different for different frequencies. Mm-hmm. So after that, will it still be the separation will not be the same?
Well, yes, different modes will be at different stages. So you could have that one mode is in an adiabatic regime when the other one is not. So the situation will depend, I mean, whether or not we are in the adiabatic regime will depend on which mode we are looking at and at what time we're looking at it. And we will go through that in detail. It's a good point. All of this is very sensitive to what the omega is, but omega depends on k, and it also depends on the time. So in particular, we look into the case when omega squared becomes negative. That will lead us to the wave picture, just because a particle picture isn't even possible anymore. But it's not just that we retreat to the wave picture because particle picture doesn't work anymore, but the wave picture becomes fundamental, and very plausibly so. As we will see in cosmology, the interactions are basically gravitational interactions, the interaction between fields and curvature. It's more important than the interaction among fields. More important will be the interaction between fields and curvature. And we will find that for that purpose, it will be very important, not so much, you know, how particles scatter off each other, but the contribution that fields make to the energy momentum tensor. Because this is how fields interact with curvature. the fields produce an energy momentum tensor. And then in the Einstein equation, that's the right-hand side of the Einstein equation, the Einstein equation relates the energy momentum to the curvature. So we have that the fields and their derivatives enter into the energy momentum tensor, and that curves the space. In particular, we will have that there are energy momentum fluctuations because of field fluctuations, and then through the Einstein equation, that leads to curvature fluctuations. In fact, we will see that also curvature fluctuates on its own. The metric fluctuates on its own as well. So there will be a relationship between the fluctuations of curvature degrees of freedom, or metric degrees of freedom, and field degrees of freedom, such as of the Klein-Gordon field. This situation is it's not the first time that one encounters that in physics. Think, for example, of the Casimir effect. In the Casimir effect, you have two parallel plates of metal that are neutral. And yet, there is an attractive force between the two plates, which has been measured, by the way. How come? Well, there is a simple picture that is often invoked for this. Imagine you have two ships on the ocean. They're parked in parallel. And the ocean is somewhat agitated. So there are waves going on everywhere, between the ships and outside. Now those waves will crash against the hulls of our two ships. But there will be more waves crashing against the hulls from the outside, from the open ocean, than from the inside, because they shield each other a little bit. So overall, there is more wave pressure coming from the outside than from the inside, and so the two ships will tend to approach each other, a phenomenon that's been known among sailors for hundreds, perhaps thousands of years. So here now, we have, in the Casimir effect, two metal plates. And they, just like the boat prevents waves from propagating through, water waves from propagating through. In the case of electromagnetism, the metal plates will prevent electromagnetic waves from traveling through the plates. So the idea is that the vacuum of the electromagnetic field is fluctuating, and there's more pressure from the fluctuations outside the plates than from in between. And therefore, there's a net pressure that presses the two plates towards each other. The situation is, I mean, this is sort of a valid picture. However, that's not the full story. Really, what's going on is this. The electromagnetic field is fluctuating everywhere, of course. But on those metal plates are charges. Yes, overall, the plates are neutral. But there are charges. If there weren't any charges, electromagnetic fields could travel through. Right? So there have to be charges. And totally, they are neutral, but they are there. And those charges will fluctuate. There are also currents. Not that we induce currents in the metal. No, those currents will just flow. They will just quantum fluctuate. If you describe a metal, you will quantum theoretically, you will have charge and current fluctuations. And those charge and current fluctuations, through the Maxwell equation, are producing electromagnetic field fluctuations. Vice versa, you can also argue that the fluctuations of electromagnetic fields induce fluctuations of currents and charges. And really, it is futile to some extent to argue, you know, one is primary or the other is. You can say that the fluctuations of charges and currents are producing electromagnetic fluctuations, but you can also argue the other way around. After all, they are coupled through the quantized Maxwell equation. Not all degrees of freedom of the electromagnetic field are coupled to all degrees of freedom of the charges and the currents, as is the case here as well. Not all of the degrees of freedom of the metric and curvature will be coupled to degrees of freedom of the Klein-Gordon field. But some are. And in that case, we cannot really distinguish what is the driver and what is the driven. Just keep in mind that there are equations that couple the two, like the Maxwell equations in the case of electromagnetism and the Casimir effect, and like the Einstein equations here. Okay, so the way that quantum fluctuations will have an impact in cosmology in our course is that those quantum fluctuations of the Klein-Gordon field, and that's the only thing we've so far studied, the quantum fluctuations of the Klein-Gordon field through the Einstein equation, through the energy momentum tensor that they produce, through the Einstein equation, will produce curvature fluctuations. And those curvature fluctuations affect everything, right? Because that's the stage on which everything happens. And so those curvature fluctuations then imprint themselves on the cosmic microwave background, and of course on the gas that emitted the cosmic microwave background. And that gas, after it expanded a lot, eventually condensed into galaxies, and whatever inhomogeneities there were in the gas would later be in the distribution of galaxies in the universe. But of course, quantum fluctuations are ordinarily very, very small. We don't usually see a lot of fluctuations between me and you now, for example. We don't really see many fluctuations going on. They do happen. It just happens with extremely small amplitude. If you want quantum fluctuations of a large amplitude, then you need to look at quantum fluctuations of very, very small wavelengths. In fact, as we will see, quantum fluctuations of a very small wavelength tend to have really, really large amplitudes. In fact, divergently so. If you look at smaller and smaller wavelengths, the amplitudes that are typical will actually diverge. And what we will see is that in the very early universe cosmology, in the very early universe, the expansion was apparently so dramatic that even those large amplitude quantum fluctuations of short wavelengths were grabbed by the expansion and expanded to large wavelengths while keeping their large amplitude. And that is thought to be the mechanism for the generating of sufficiently large amplitude fluctuations in the CMB and therefore in the universe. Okay, so we want to calculate the effect that space-time expansion, especially the dramatic expansion that is thought to have occurred very, very early on the quantum fluctuations of a field. Later, we will also look at the quantum fluctuations of the metric. Our strategy will be this. First, we study the typical amplitude of quantum fluctuations as a function of their spatial size. I already anticipated large amplitude, large wavelength fluctuations, fluctuations that are very big in a spatial sense, typically will have a very small amplitude, but those of small spatial extent typically have very large amplitude. And then, secondly, we will check how that relationship is affected by expansion. How small size, small spatial size fluctuations can be stretched out to even cosmological scales. So here, I have to remind you of something that we did at the beginning of the course. Consider a real-valued function f. So it maps R3 into R. It gives at every point in space an amplitude, a real-valued amplitude. Then we consider that state of the quantum field theory, which we call f, which is the joint eigenstate of all the field operators at all points in space at a given time, eta naught. So we are looking at that state f of the quantum field theory for which the field operator produces the eigenvalue times that state again. Field operator at every point in space. If our quantum field could be prepared in that state f, then we could predict with certainty what the outcome would be of any amplitude measurement anywhere. If we measure the amplitude at the point x, so we measure phi hat at the point x, well, the outcome would be the value f of x, because that's the eigenvalue. The system, remember that in quantum theory, if a system is in an eigenstate to an observable, then measuring that observable will produce a predictable result, the eigenvalue. without any uncertainty. So the state F is defined to be the eigenstate to all of those observables. I mean, they are not really observable directly, but they're self-adjoint operators. So as such, they qualify in principle as observables. Now, let's ask, is it in principle possible to prepare a quantum field in such a field eigenstate? Is it possible to prepare a quantum field, like the Klein-Gordon field, in a state such that the outcome of the field amplitude measurements everywhere can be predicted with certainty because it's the joint eigenstate of all those observables? Well, it turns out that that's not possible. I was speaking too fast. I'll show you in a moment why it's not possible. First, let's look at the properties of that state, if it could be produced. Well, if the quantum field could be put in that state, if it could be prepared in that state F, then what would be the expectation value? Well, the expectation value of measuring the field operator phi at the position x, at the time eta naught when we prepared it, is given by, well, the expectation value, and here we have the field operator. But the field operator acting on f just produces the eigenvalue, which is f of x. So we just get f of x. So the expectation value is f. And what's the uncertainty in that prediction? Well, it's just calculated. Here's the variance, standard deviation squared. The variance is given by the actual field value minus the field expectation value squared, and of that, the expectation value. That's the usual definition of a variance. And we know we already calculated what phi bar is, the field expectation value. It's just f. So we put for this f here. And here we have phi, but phi acting on f, left or right, doesn't matter. Phi acting on f produces the eigenvalue, which is f again. So we simply have f minus f. Whole thing squared, expectation value, that's zero. So that's just calculating what I anticipated earlier, indeed, that if we could prepare the quantum field in that state F, then we could predict the outcome of all the field amplitude measurements to be F of X without any uncertainty. So now to the question, can such states F occur in nature? The answer is no. And the reason is that such states would have infinite energy. I wrote it up here for the Hamiltonian H chi, but you could equally well show it for the Hamiltonian H phi, or indeed for the energy momentum tensor. I leave it to you to prove that this is the case, that such a state F would have infinite energy. Ultimately, the reason is that the Hamiltonian has a chi squared term in it and a pi squared term in it. Right? The kinetic term is pi squared, and the other harmonic oscillator term is chi squared. Now, if the state is a chi eigenstate, so the uncertainty in chi is zero, then the uncertainty in the canonically conjugate field variable pi must be infinite, which is to say that the expectation value of that operator pi squared has to be infinite. But pi squared is in the Hamiltonian, so the expectation value of the Hamiltonian is infinite. I meant it as an exercise, but I gave it away already. Okay, but still, it might be worth just carrying it out. So that has a crucial consequence. Namely, even that state, F, which is an eigenstate of the field operators, with all eigenvalues being equal to zero is not possible, because it's one of those states, right? It's the state which predicts that the field measurement, the measurement of the field phi anywhere, would come out with, would come back with a value zero. The field amplitude is zero everywhere with certainty. Even that state would have infinite energy, because it's an eigenstate of the phi operators with eigenvalue zero. But any eigenstate of the phi operators must have infinite energy. This is ultimately the reason why the vacuum fluctuates. This is the reason why there is no state in which the field wouldn't fluctuate. In principle, you can write it down, but it has infinite energy. Cannot even approach that state, no matter what you do experimentally. You can try to suppress the quantum fluctuations. You can do that to some extent by preparing the field appropriately, but it will cost you energy. And the vacuum state is almost the state of lowest energy. So clearly, it's nowhere near that state which would predict with certainty that the amplitude is zero everywhere. The vacuum state should be expected to have lots of fluctuation. Mm-hmm.
What makes this different from first quantization? Because in first quantization, the Hamiltonian has an x and a p.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like you can prepare.
Yeah. That's my question to you. It's an exercise. Well, not. OK, let me give it away since you're asking. There are plenty of exercises. Imagine for a harmonic oscillator, you have x and p. Just like here for the field oscillators, you have phi and pi. For the harmonic oscillator in first quantization, you have x and p. So imagine now you have an x eigenstate. Just like here, you have a phi eigenstate. You have an x eigenstate. It means that you're considering a harmonic oscillator, and the state is a position eigenstate, a delta peak in position space. And now let's ask, if you prepare a harmonic oscillator in a position eigenstate, what's the energy? Turns out it's infinite. For the same reason, delta x goes very small, delta p goes very large. In fact, it goes infinite. Now, you can choose the momentum expectation value to be zero. So therefore, delta p squared is simply the expectation value of p squared, which is the uncertainty in p squared. So that's got to be infinite. So if you want to create a particle, if you want in first quantization to put a particle into a harmonic oscillator, which is very, very sharply localized, it'll cost you energy. A lot. Eventually, it's diverges as you want to approach the Dirac delta peak. It's not only true for the harmonic oscillator, though, because all reasonable first quantized Hamiltonians have a p squared over 2m term in them. And that will always diverge in this case.
But we could put it in a, so I guess I misunderstood, because I thought you were saying that we also couldn't put the field in a pi eigenstate.
That's true for the field. Yes, for fields, we cannot put it into a pi eigenstate, because then the phi squared term would explode. And the same in first quantization. If you take a harmonic oscillator, then if you put it in a position eigenstate, then the p squared term in the Hamiltonian will blow up. If you put it in a momentum eigenstate, then the x squared term in the Hamiltonian will blow up. If you have a free particle, and you don't have an x squared term, and you can put it in a p eigenstate, a plane wave. OK, so what we observed is that having eigenstates of all the field operators is energetically too expensive. Divergingly so, cannot have. So in particular, a state which would predict that the field is vanishing everywhere with certainty, energetically way too expensive. The vacuum state, which is almost a state of lowest energy, certainly is nowhere near having no fluctuations. You cannot predict what the amplitude is going to be. So all finite energy states, and therefore all states in nature, will have quantum fluctuations. So now assume that the system is in some finite energy state psi. Let's just call the state in which the system happens to be, time. Then at that time, let's call it eta naught, we could measure the field operators everywhere. So we measure phi hat of x everywhere for all x in R3. Then we get everywhere some value from those measurements. We can ask what's the probability for a particular outcome. An outcome can be described by giving the measurement outcome as a function of position. So we can ask, and remember that if, once we've done that, in principle, the system then collapses into an eigenstate of all the phi operators. Right? Because we measured, we found a particular amplitude, and now we have it. We are sure about it. The state collapses into that eigenstate, and so we end up with that state F. So now, if this system is in some finite energy state psi, we can ask, what's the probability for finding a particular outcome for the amplitudes if we measure them at a particular time? And the outcome of the amplitudes could be, for example, given by some function f, which relates to a joint eigenvector to all of the phi operators that we called f. And then this overlap function, this overlap amplitude modulus squared gives us, in principle, the probability for finding that particular outcome. So if the system is in some state psi, then this formula gives us the probability for finding, if we measure, the amplitudes to have particular values all over space. And in general, whatever function you choose here, you will get some overlap there. You get some probability that you actually find that outcome. Let's look at the case of Minkowski space. In Minkowski space, we calculated that explicitly. Remember that the outcome of measuring the field everywhere can be given in two ways, in many ways really, but two basic ways. One is we describe the amplitude everywhere at every point, f of x. That's one way of describing a measurement outcome. Another way to describe the measurement outcome is to give the Fourier coefficients of this function. And what we did at the beginning of the course is we considered a box, large box, such that the Fourier transform became a Fourier series expansion. And then the two ways of describing measurement outcomes of the field are either you give the amplitude f of x for all points in the box, or you give the Fourier coefficients for f in the box. And those Fourier coefficients we call the f index k. And we calculated using the functional Schrödinger equation and also the operator approach what the probability is. So we calculated what is the probability for finding a particular measurement outcome, so a particular function f of x in the box, if we measure all the amplitudes, given that the system is in the vacuum state. In Minkowski space, easy to write down the Minkowski state, the vacuum state. And here's the answer that we found. Up to a normalizing prefactor, we found that the probability for finding a particular measurement outcome f of x, if the field is in the vacuum state, is given by this expression here, where we have to sum over all modes k, frequencies omega k, and here are the Fourier coefficients. So if you want to know how likely is it that a particular f of x comes out if I measure the field everywhere, then just take that f, calculate its Fourier coefficients, plug those Fourier coefficients in here, and you get the unnormalized probability for this outcome to happen. In practice, of course, if you want to do it numerically, you can't sum this up over all modes, so you sum it up over as many modes as the computer can handle. And in the case of Minkowski space, that probability is, of course, time independent because the vacuum state is time independent. Now, it is not realistic, of course, to measure all those operators phi of x, to measure the amplitude everywhere, really, in nature. Can't do that. We can't measure the amplitude of a field at a point. What kind of instrument would you use to specify a point, mathematically speaking, a point of no extent? Can't do this. And in any case, all the technical problems aside, we know that it would involve infinite amounts of energy. Because if we could pull off such a measurement, we would end up with a phi eigenstate, which we know has infinite energy. So independently of the technical difficulties, we know that the energy budget is going to be out of our range. Therefore, let us look at a more realistic way of dealing with this, which is, by the way, quite related to how you would do it on a computer. Remember, on the computer, you can't really sum this thing up all the way to infinity. You use just a finite number of modes, which means that you'll be insensitive to fluctuations that are smaller than the shortest wavelength mode that you consider. We are smearing over those modes. We just don't get them, which is realistic. A realistic experiment is not going to see individual points, but just an average over an area. So let's formalize that now in a different way, not just by neglecting higher Fourier coefficients, which is a nice way to do it, but there are other ways as well, and more analytic ways to do it. So here's a solution. Realistically, we can measure an average of the values of a field over some region B, which is a patch in R3, where the volume is not all too small. It's not going to be a Planck length size cube. Can't do that. So we can consider it, but in practice, we are nowhere near being able to do this. So what we could do is this. We cannot measure that operator here at that point. It's just not doable. It would cost us infinite amount of energy. But what if we integrate that operator over a patch of real estate in space? So we integrate our field operator with some window function that is zero outside the patch. So that window function is a constant value inside that patch. And outside, that window function is vanishing. In this way, we can integrate over R3. We might as well just drop the window function and integrate over the patch, but it will turn out to be analytically a little easier to have a window function here. So what we do is we are looking not at just the individual observables at one point, but instead we sum over all those observables in a patch. And then we declare that sum of observables, one observable phi. One observable phi with index b. This is what we can actually measure. If a measurement instrument has a resolution of the size of this patch, this is what it measures. It measures the average. Can't resolve better than that. Just get the average. And then we can ask, well, what's the expectation value of this thing as an observable now? What's the expectation value of it, and what are the fluctuations of it? And how does the expectation value, how does the size of the fluctuation depend on the size of the spatial extent of the region? OK, so let's do that. Just to specify the window function. The window function is assumed to be vanishing outside the patch. So for all x which are not in the patch B. And inside the patch B, the window function is defined to have value inverse of its volume, inverse of the patch's volume, such that if you integrate the window function, you get one. Okay, so let's apply that to Friedman-Robertson-Walker space-time. Let's choose a conformal time eta, some time, and choose co-moving coordinates. Remember, we've always been choosing co-moving coordinates, but now is a good time to remind ourselves of that. Now, choose a region B, over which we will average, of size L by L by L. Numerically, it's L by L by L in co-moving coordinates, which means that in proper coordinates, in proper distances as measured by yardsticks, we are going to have a box of increasing size, where the size is A times L times A times L times A times L. Right? Because the co-moving coordinates are coordinates on a coordinate system that is growing with the expansion. So if in the coordinate system you have a fixed numerical distance, well, the physical distance is growing. Remember that in co-moving coordinates, a galaxy has always the same coordinates. And two neighboring galaxies, or just two arbitrary galaxies, since they will always have the same coordinates, will always have the same numerical distance. But the proper distance actually is growing. So similarly here, using those coordinates, a box of size L by L by L actually physically is a box of growing size. Let's assume that the system, the quantum field, is initially in the vacuum state. So at the time eta naught, it's in the state which is described by a vector zero. And we call that vacuum state also omega. Then let's ask, what is the expectation value of this patch averaged field at that time? So we're looking at this observable, phi b, the averaged field amplitude. We calculate its expectation value. That's why we put a bar over it. Well, here we have the vacuum state, the operator. The vacuum, omega is the vacuum state at time eta naught, which is also the state zero for suitable for the correct mode function. Let's say we have used the adiabatic vacuum identification criterion. And we can write this operator in terms of its definition, namely the integral over the field operators smeared with a window function. The field operator can be expressed in terms of chi. Remember that phi and chi are related simply by a prefactor, which is the scaling factor. Well, and we have now that the field chi can be expressed in terms of the mode functions and the creation and annihilation operators. And we have that this operator, the annihilation operator acting on the vacuum, gives us a zero, and the A dagger acting on here gives us a zero. Or you could also view it this way, that the A dagger acting on that creates an excited state, which is then orthogonal to the vacuum state. Okay, so what we found is that the expectation value of that smeared over variable is zero. Just like the expectation value of phi itself was zero in the vacuum state. It's no more likely to be fluctuating into positive values than it is to fluctuate into negative values. And that carries forward to the smeared over version as well. However, what about the vacuum fluctuations? So we know that this is vanishing in the vacuum state. Can we predict the outcome of the measurement of phi b? No, we can only predict its average. What about the fluctuations about the average? What about the variance of measuring the smeared over field? Well, easy to calculate. As usual, the variance is calculated this way. The expectation value of the actual value minus the mean value squared. and the expectation value thereof. It's the expected mean square deviation. That's what the variance is. We know that the mean is zero. We just calculated that. So overall, it's just the expectation value of phi squared, where phi index b really is the operator that has been smeared over the patch. So it's not the smearing of the square, it's the square of the smearing, right? So it's this thing squared. Okay, so that is explicitly this expression here. The phi translates into a chi over a, but it's squared. So it's a phi b, so it's actually smeared over the patch. And then the factor a comes in twice because phi is really chi over a. So phi squared is chi squared over a squared. Now I leave it to you as an exercise to fill in the next few steps. Quite straightforward, but still valuable to do. You just do a Fourier transform of the variables in here. And then you obtain that the variance in the measurement of the smeared over of the patch smeared field phi over the region B is given by that. And notice that whatever the outcome of this was going to be, it's clear already that it will depend on the window function, right? It sort of features in this. And what that tells us is that the amount of fluctuations in that patch depend on how big the patch is going to be. Let's estimate how big those fluctuations are for a given patch and then vary the patch size. What would we expect? If we make the patch very big, then we would expect, I guess, that there's going to be a lot of averaging out of fluctuations. Therefore, the overall fluctuation size might not be so big. Whereas if we have a patch that's very small, maybe more of the original fluctuations that are in phi will come through. And so it would be more fluctuations. Let's see if this pans out. So far we have this expression for the fluctuation, for the variance of the field when smeared over the patch. And let's now assume that our patch is spherical, just for simplicity. Then we can go to polar coordinates, and instead of d3k, we now have 4 pi k squared, and an integral over the radius in momentum space. And since the whole thing is rotationally symmetric, we got rid of the angle integrations that just gave us a factor of 4 pi. So overall, we now have this. Now we do a few approximations. Let's look at the window function. The window function is a certain finite value inside the patch, and it vanishes outside the patch. We can choose the window function, for example, to look like this. And when x reaches L, that's when the window function has to drop down to about zero. So what we can assume here is, because of that, we can assume that the Fourier transform of the window function drops to about zero for all momenta that are larger than 1 over L. Let me give you an example. Let's say we choose that window function, just to justify that. Let's say we choose that window function to be straightforward the box. Constant value here, and then it drops to zero. In that case, the Fourier transform is a sinc function. In fact, it's the product of three sinc functions, because it's a three-dimensional box, right? The Fourier transform is a sinc function, and the sinc function decays like 1 over k. And it's big initially, But then at from the scale 2 pi over L onwards, it's pretty small. So, you know, just for a rough estimate, we're dealing with fluctuations after all. Let's just say that the window function vanishes outside that range, which means that up to some prefactors of order 1, something like that, we have that the size of the fluctuations is given by that integral where we no longer integrate all the way to infinity. We just integrate up to 2 pi over L. Otherwise, the same formula as before. Also, we notice that while we integrate here from 0 to 2 pi over L, the low carry values are really suppressed very much because they're multiplied with k squared. So it doesn't really matter that much what the vk does for the lower k values. And therefore, another very crude approximation that personally I probably wouldn't do, but in the literature you will find it done. Another crude approximation is to say that we just plug in here the value at the upper end of the integral, where it matters most. This has the huge advantage that this thing is no longer k-dependent, so that we can integrate it. Right? So we say that what exactly the value here is at low values doesn't matter much because it's suppressed, and so we choose this to be the value that it has at the endpoint. So then we have that the size of the fluctuations is approximately given by this formula here, where we now no longer have v of k, where k is something we integrate over, but we replaced it by the value where the constant value where it has the most important contribution. So now that's a constant that we can put in front. And then that integral just gives us, you know, integral dk over k squared, that's a k to the third power. So now we can indeed work out that integral here. And what we obtain is that the size of the fluctuation, or the variance really, is given approximately by 1 over a squared, just carrying this forward. K to the third power arises from integrating this thing. And then we have that value here taken in front. But k, in principle, there ought to be k in here, but we replace it by the most important value, which is 2 pi over L. So we can write it like this, where the k is to be replaced by pi over L, 2 pi over L. You see, when you integrate this k squared, you get a k to the third, which you have to evaluate at the endpoint. The endpoint is 2 pi over L, so you get a factor of k to the third, which is to be evaluated at 2 pi over L. And this value here is that. So the whole thing can be written in terms of k, just a bit simpler because k is easier written than 2 pi over L. So that's one way of writing what the size of the fluctuations is. If the system is in the vacuum state, described by the mode function that gives us this representation of the field. So another way of writing this expression is in this way, where we replace all occurrences of k with 2 pi over L, and we get that. Now let's look at this for a moment. This is going to be crucial. So let's assume that at the time eta naught, the vacuum state was the state 0, which comes with those mode functions. For example, determined through the adiabatic vacuum criterion. So let's assume that the field was prepared, or happened to be, in that vacuum state at an early time. Then what we calculated was the expectation value, we calculate the variance in the measurement of feed fluctuations at an arbitrary time. Right? We calculated that for chi of eta, phi of eta. We assumed that the system is in the state zero, but you know, this is the Heisenberg picture. If it was early on, it always will be in that state zero. What that means is this. Imagine that we have a cosmological model in which we can say that at a very early time, the universe was in the vacuum state. The vacuum state was the state zero that came along with a particular mode function v. In this case, we can then calculate the predictions for any observables that we want at any later time. In particular, we can calculate that thing at any later time. All we have to do is evolve in time the v. So in practice, it means the following calculation needs to be done. Very early in the universe, you assume it is prepared in the vacuum state. How do you identify the vacuum state? Well, you use the adiabatic vacuum identification criterion. So that gives you the amplitude and the derivative for the mode function that you have to choose. Given the amplitude and the derivative of the mode function v, you can use the Klein-Gordon equation to evolve v to all time. And once you have v at any time, if you have calculated, let's say, numerically or analytically, then you can answer all questions about predictions in the future, because you know what state the system is in, and you can evolve your operators, because we have that. Right? We have the time-dependent operators, so we can smear them, calculate predictions. So if you want to know how big are the quantum fluctuations in the field at a particular time, well, that's the answer. It turns out that, well, let's look at this here. It turns out that if you want to know how big are the quantum fluctuations on average, how big are the field fluctuations, what is the variance in the field fluctuations at a late time eta, if we measure it with a measurement instrument of size B, that measures a region B. And this is the answer here. It tells us that the answer is time dependent. It will go like this expression divided by a squared here. So mode function squared divided by a squared. And it will also go by 1 over L to the third power. Two things to consider. What does that mean, mode function divided by a, mode function squared divided by a squared? Well, that's the mode function for chi. The mode function for phi is v divided by a. So really, what we have here is the mode function for phi. I mean, this divided by that is the mode function for phi, where v is alone is the mode function for chi. So it's just this factor multiplied with the mode function for phi. So what we see is that the size of the quantum fluctuations can be studied in two dimensions, in time, forward in time. For that, we need to find out what the time evolution is of the mode function according to the Klein-Gordon equation. In this case, we are holding the size of the box fixed. We are holding the co-moving size of the box fixed. Or we hold the time fixed, in which case this is just a number, and we run through the size of the box. And while we cannot immediately tell what the time evolution of the mode function is going to be, we have to work that out, we can already tell from this equation how the quantum fluctuations behave at a fixed point in time when I change the size of the box over which I'm measuring. Because that was L. And what we see here is that the variance in the measurement of the smeared field operator, the variance goes like 1 over L to the third power, which is to say that the standard deviation of the fluctuations goes like 1 over L to the power 3 half. This is assuming that there's no non-trivial stuff happening in here. We will see how these things come out. The last remark was just to say that, as I already mentioned, that this is mode function divided by A squared, but this mode function divided by A is the mode function of phi. Okay, so this is one way to measure quantum fluctuations as a function of the size over which we are smearing. There's another way to measure quantum fluctuations, which we will introduce the next time on Thursday. And the idea there is to measure how the fluctuations at one point are correlating with the fluctuations at a neighboring point. If the field fluctuates positive or negative here, well, the field also fluctuates positive or negative over there, but not in an uncorrelated way. They will be correlated, those fluctuations. And the closer two points are, the more they are correlated. When you measure the cosmic microwave background, you can ask that question too. You can ask, well, if it's a little hotter over there, then nearby, what are the chances that another point is also having excess heat? Or should it be a little colder? You can measure also in the on the C&B map the two-point correlation functions for the fluctuations. So we will look at fluctuations in basically three ways, quantum fluctuations. We will study their correlation functions, the variance over smeared patches, and in your project, the typical quantum fluctuations when you have an ultraviolet cutoff, which means you're throwing away modes of wavelengths shorter than a fixed amount, and that amounts to smearing over any wavelengths that are, I mean, over patches that are of size, of the size of the smallest wavelengths that you still take into account. Yeah, and then of course we'll have to calculate those things and calculate exactly what the behavior of the scaling behavior of the quantum fluctuations is with respect to the size of the box and with respect to time. That's it. Continue on Thursday.